WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Plaintiffs in a civil lawsuit over white supremacist violence in Charlottesville say the defendants are withholding information in the case and they should be punished. We explore whether public schools in Virginia are doing all they can to help students who don't get enough to eat. And we begin an occasional series on housing in our area. This is the WMRA Daily for Tuesday, June 4th. White supremacist defendants in a civil suit over the violent 2017 rallies in Charlottesville are withholding information and could face harsh sanctions. The Daily Progress reports that three of the two dozen defendants in the federal lawsuit, including the neo-Nazi organization Vanguard America, have repeatedly ignored discovery requests, the plaintiff said in court in Charlottesville on Monday. The suit was filed in October 2017 by a group of area residents against organizers and key participants in the deadly Unite the Right white supremacist rally. Charlottesville will soon remove all investments in weapons and fossil fuels companies. City Council voted Monday night, 4-1, to complete those divestments in the next 30 days. NBC 29 reports that residents have been asking the city to pull out of its investments in these companies. The city's core investment portfolio ranges from $50 million to $100 million. An official said fossil fuel and weapons companies make up only a small portion of that portfolio, so divestment will have a minimal budgetary impact. Virginians who lost their driver's licenses due to unpaid court costs will be able to get their licenses back beginning July 1st. Governor Ralph Northam's office announced Monday that the DMV will send a letter to each driver whose license was suspended. This year, the General Assembly passed legislation that ended the state's practice of suspending driving privileges for failing to pay court costs and fines. The change only affects a person's ability to get his or her driver's license. It does not eliminate the requirement to pay the underlying court costs and fines. The shooting in Virginia Beach over the weekend is prompting a familiar discussion about firearms and whether new restrictions are needed. From Virginia Public Radio, Michael Pope reports.
It's been a dozen years since the shooting at Virginia Tech when a student killed 32 people. But after last weekend's shooting at Virginia Beach, the politics feels familiar. Republicans are calling for thoughts and prayers while Democrats are calling for gun control. Democratic strategist Ben Tribbett says Democrats run the risk of sounding too extreme, too close to a tragedy.
I think when you get into the things about particular types of guns, it sounds like you're trying to take people's guns away and half of the population just stops listening.
Republican strategist Dan Scanling says Republicans aren't feeling much heat to do much of anything on the gun issue.
I don't think it hurt them after Virginia Tech, sadly. So I think that's where they're going to default to. And I think you're going to hear Republicans come back and say the weapons that were used were purchased legally.
Scanling says one issue where there might be some room to maneuver is law surrounding high-capacity magazines, like the kind used in the Virginia Beach shooting. But he adds it's too soon to see if there could be any movement on that issue.
Hunger is a problem in Virginia schools. Educators say students can't learn if they're hungry, but are schools doing all they can about the problem? Michael Pope has that story.
One of the lingering problems with free or reduced price lunch is the stigma it carries with it for students who have to prove they live in poverty to get a meal. That's why the federal government created a program for schools in high poverty areas where every student gets a free lunch. Last year, 48% of eligible schools participated, and this year it's 58%. Chris Duncombe at the Commonwealth Institute says that's a positive trend.
I think it shows the growing popularity of the program and schools learning about the increased benefits and reduced administrative burden on schools that participate. But despite this progress, there's still quite a number of schools that are eligible that are not participating.
Claire Mansfield at No Kid Hungry Virginia says most of the high poverty schools have already signed up. And for schools with a lower rate of eligibility, it's a difficult balancing act.
The lower your eligibility for the program, the lower percentage of reimbursement you're going to receive. That is why some schools at the lower ends of eligibility are not able to financially make it work.
Schools across Virginia are now facing the choice of whether they want to participate in the community eligibility program or not. The deadline is a month away. I'm Michael Pope.
Finally today, houses in Harrisonburg are selling more quickly and going for higher prices than in the past. The growth of James Madison University is sometimes cited as the main factor. But there's more to it than that. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports in the first of an occasional series on housing in our area.
Tensions between long-term Harrisonburg residents and college students are nothing new. Noise levels in neighborhoods, increased traffic, and the remnants of Greek house raves scattered on front lawns are common topics of complaint against students. Increasingly, so is the availability of housing in Harrisonburg. According to James Madison University's Office of Institutional Research, since 2010, enrollment has grown by about 1,800 to its current level of 20,798 students. At a recent Poverty Interrupted panel in Harrisonburg, Shannon Porter, executive director of the nonprofit organization Mercy House, cited the last 4 or 5 years as an especially rapid period of enrollment growth.
During that time, they've developed minimal housing. That has forced the student population into our community. It's taken capacity out of the marketplace.
Of course, an increase of 1,800 students in the last 9 years affects housing availability. But Harrisonburg's population as a whole, including those students, has grown by more than 5,000 residents in that time, according to federal census estimates. So the students account for about a third of the city's total population growth.
More people seem to want to move to this area than move out.
Scott Rogers, a real estate agent with the Funkhauser Real Estate Group, has been studying the local housing market for 12 years. And while he notes that the number of overall sales has been on a gradual upward trend since 2010, the pace of those sales has increased dramatically.
When homes are coming on the market, they're selling, going under contract much more quickly, which is keeping inventory numbers low.
From April 2018 to March 2019, houses in the city sold 22% faster than in the preceding year, according to Rogers' April market report. Rogers says that typically developers would see that increased pace of sales and build new homes to sell or rent. But currently, Harrisonburg is at a bottleneck of high demand and insufficient new construction.
We're big enough to be a great place for people to want to live, but we're small enough to where it's not necessarily sustainable for those regional or national builders to come in and start buying land and build. And so we're kind of, in some ways, caught in the middle.
Charlottesville may be getting past their own bottleneck. The Charlottesville Area Association of Realtors reports that after a few years of growth in the number of area home sales and decreasing inventory, those numbers have begun to stabilize. And while the median sales price continues to climb, it's doing so more slowly, and houses are generally taking a bit longer to sell than last year. The Charlottesville area does have a booming market for new construction. Jim Duncan, a realtor with Nest Realty, said that 4 large developers accounted for over half the single-family homes sold in the first quarter of this year in Albemarle County, and that proportion has been even higher in the last few years. In contrast, there is only 1 regional developer active in Harrisonburg, Evergreen Homes, which is building the Preston Lake development on the east end of town. There are a number of barriers that prevent smaller, local developers from building houses more quickly: the rising costs of certain building materials, the cost of raw land, and the limited availability of contractors and subcontractors. And in many parts of the city, housing is already as dense as its residential zone allows. Ton Dang, Harrisonburg's Assistant Director of Planning and Community Development, explains.
How can they develop that property and still, you know, make their ends meet, you know, pay all their bills, pay all their contractors and, you know, everything? It will depend somewhat on the number of dwellings that they can fit on that property.
Dang's office recently drafted a new zoning class, R8, or small lot residential, which would allow some property owners to divide their lots and build a small house or duplex on the second lot. Harrisonburg's Planning Commission voted unanimously in favor of R8. Dang said the proposal now goes before City Council for approval on June 11th. But the number of dwellings allowed per acre isn't just an arbitrary number. It corresponds with the capacity of nearby infrastructure, such as roads and water lines. New construction on more than an acre must also remediate stormwater runoff. J.M. Snell, co-owner of Valley Renovators, says that can raise the construction price of each new house by around $10,000. There are a variety of best management practices to achieve that remediation, from expensive technologies such as underground cisterns to more affordable landscaping measures such as rain gardens.
The easiest way to manage or to improve the stormwater's quality is to just store it, hold it, let it run off of your acre, store it in the corner of your acre, give the nutrients a chance to fall out and drain slowly and be absorbed into the soil.
But landscaping like that takes up surface area that otherwise could be used to build more houses, driving up the prices of the houses that do get built. The more a house costs to buy, the more likely a prospective buyer is to choose to rent instead. Funkhauser's Scott Rogers explains.
So it is creating more of a demand on the rental market, which is then potentially making someone who's looking at buying a piece of land to build townhouses say, "Oh my heavens, there's so much demand for rentals. Why don't I just rent them instead?"
For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Haight.
Learn more about that story at WMRA.org. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your Tuesday.